Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Kenneth H. Cooper as my special expert guest. Dr. Kenneth Cooper, preventive medicine pioneer and father of aerobics, introduced the concept of exercising in pursuit of good health when he launched the worldwide phenomenon aerobics in 1968, his first of 19 books on health and fitness. His latest book, Start Strong, Finish Strong, is a collaboration with his son, Tyler Cooper, MD. A former Air Force flight surgeon, Dr. Cooper invented the 12-minute and the 1.5-mile fitness tests and aerobics point system. For more than 40 years, Dr. Cooper's scientific research and expertise has shown that it's easier to maintain good health than to regain it once it's lost. Dr. Cooper is founder and chairman of the renowned Cooper Aerobic Center in Dallas, the home of 9 health and wellness companies, including the Cooper Clinic and research nonprofit, the Cooper Institute. His current focus is working to help reverse the childhood obesity epidemic through school-based physical fitness programs and assessments. Good morning, Dr. Cooper. Welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
It's our pleasure and honor. As a medical doctor, can you please tell us why you're attracted to preventive medicine and the use of exercise and nutrition as a form of medical therapy?
My feeling is that we spend way too much of our health service dollar on desperate measures, which often prolongs death, not life, a miserable few days. That's the reason that in the United States, we're in a very desperate situation. We're spending 18% of the GDP on health care. It's getting worse by the day. The only way that that can be changed is we start emphasizing the practice of preventive medicine. The data is undeniable. Look at some of the corporate worksite wellness programs. Safeway, for example, in San Francisco, a four-year period, they kept their cost of health care flat. While in the same period of time, the average American corporation increased their health care expenditures by 38%. So the way of the future, the necessity of the future, is emphasize prevention of disease, not the treatment of disease.
Well, I just returned to Vancouver after an 18-month tour of the United States. We went to 19 states, and of course, Texas was one of them. And what a difference when we came back to see the difference in the actual stature of people. You know, Canadians are much slimmer, and we've got this national healthcare system. Do you think that the healthcare system or the lack of it in the United States is part of the problem?
No, I don't. Until we get rid of some of the entitlements in which people have to do nothing and still get reimbursed for it, and still we get more personal responsibility, we're not going to ever control the cost of health care. And that's why so many of our diseases that we have are the result of our behavior, and many can be prevented, others can be effectively treated by lifestyle. And that's why you and I both have been involved in what I call 21st century medicine, which is proper weight, proper nutrition, proper exercise, and proper supplementation. For almost 40 years, we've been researching those various factors here at the Cooper Institute in Dallas, and I can assure you the results we're getting are too impressive to be ignored. So I do think the future of in controlling the cost of health care is not what the government can do for us, what the insurance companies do for us, our physicians do for us, is what we can do for ourselves. That's the only hope we have.
So what do you think is the difference between Canada and America? If the treatment of the disease is not the remedy, is it our education system, or is it the lack of awareness or knowledge, or is it the fact that America has too much too soon and just too much of too much wealth? What do you think the cause of the obesity, which is much more dramatic in America, perhaps more than anywhere in the world, what is driving that?
My first book was published in 1968. We had less than 100,000 joggers. By the year 1990, we still had about 34 million joggers, hit a peak in 1984. During that time, we had a 48% decrease in deaths from coronary heart disease. We led the world. Only 3 countries had accomplished this history: Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Even then, we could see that there was great interest being expressed among the Canadians in what the baby boomers did in this country to have the dramatic decrease in the number of heart disease deaths. and that was by quitting smoking, by getting better control of blood pressure, by changing their diets, lowering their cholesterol, or their harmful effects of stress, how to control it, more people exercising. But what happened in the United States after 1990, that didn't continue. And since 1990, we've had an epidemic of obesity in the United States, in our adults, and particularly our children. And I don't think the same thing has happened in Canada. I haven't seen that. Whereas you were up with us during that 20-year period as far as reducing deaths from heart attacks and increasing longevity, and you continued that after 1990, apparently, as compared to what we've done in the United States. Is that a change in attitude? Is it because of the healthcare system? Because Canadians, by nature, are more athletic than we are in the United States? Maybe the climate, the temperature, is more effective as far as helping them control calorie consumption or burning calories? Combination of things. So I think if you look at the Scandinavian countries, some of the countries that do have a different climate, a colder climate than we have, I think you will see that there can be a difference in obesity. If you look at the increase in obesity that we've had over the last, since 1990, you see it's just in the southern states. It's the quadrant going from Florida over to Texas, Oklahoma, that without question is where we're seeing the obesity epidemic in our children and our adults. Why? Is that because of the climate? Is because of the inactivity? Because of the heat? Because of the diet? It's a combination of all those things. So put that in reverse and go above the United States-Canadian border, and you find about the same level of obesity in those northern states as you have in Canada. So I think it's more environment, it's more attitude, maybe genetic, than it is your healthcare system.
Thank you for that. Now, you're the founder and chairman of the Cooper Aerobics Center, the Cooper Clinic, and the Institute. Maybe you could tell us something about each and why they're different and named differently.
Well, we have an umbrella, which is the Cooper Aerobics Center. Under the umbrella, we have 10 different corporations now. And the principal ones are the Cooper Clinic, Cooper Institute, Cooper Fitness Center. Those are our principal ones. The Cooper Clinic is a diagnostic, preventive, and rehabilitative clinic that specializes in taking care of healthy people and keeping them healthy. It is not supported by the government, not supported by insurance. It's paid for by individuals paying it out of their own pocket. Now, the majority of people, patients who come to our clinic, well over 100,000 now since we started back in 1970, are corporate sponsored. We were listed just recently as one of the top clinics in America doing executive health examinations. So corporations are finding that the whole concept of preventive medicine is the way of the future, because we're able to show that corporations get involved in a worksite wellness program. This is well documented. It reduces the cost of the health insurance, as I mentioned recently with Safeway. It decreases absenteeism due to disease. It increases productivity of employees. It helps you recruit the best employees in the marketplace. You offer them worksite wellness program. And number five, reduces turnover among employees. So I think that's why we get the CEOs, the corporations all over the world come through here, because they get interested personally and then pass it on to their employees. So that's the major source of revenue for the Cooper Clinic. The Cooper Institute is a nonprofit 501c3 foundation. I actually established the Cooper Clinic in June 1970. I chartered the nonprofit institute here in Texas. I did not see my first patient at Cooper Clinic until December 6, 1970, because I knew I had to have undeniable data to bridge the gap between fadism and scientific legitimacy, you exercise and practice of medicine. There was no data back in those days. Even as recently, 1984, I was on the television program Nightline debating Dr. Henry Solomon, a cardiologist in New York City who had written a book entitled The Exercise Myth. He said, there's no good data. Documented exercise does anything but make you feel good, because it's all suspect. All the big epidemiological studies have been based upon questionnaires. They didn't test people. They asked them what they did. He said, they give you the answers they think you want, they exaggerate, don't remember, and sometimes outright lie. He said this on national television. And the correlation coefficient between what people say they do when they perform the laboratory on the treadmill is 0.3, almost no correlation at all. I said, Dr. Solomon, you're right. But we're in the process of doing studies in Texas that's going to blow you out of the water. And that was published in 1989, an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, entitled Physical Fitness All-Cause Mortality. And that opened up the whole world of preventive medicine and you can exercise the practice of medicine. So that's the importance of the Cooper Clinic. That's the importance of the Research Institute. I might add that our big research project now is involved in trying to evaluate the fitness and fatness of American youth, and particularly our children here in Texas. It is deplorable. We evaluated 2.6 million children last year. This is in 2008, from the 3rd to 12th grade, using what's called the fitness gram. And we just got through evaluating 2.8 million this year, starting in January 2009, on the fitness gram. And it is sad that less than a third of these students, from the 3rd grade on up, can pass a simple fitness test. And that's a reflection of our obesity, our inactivity, the food consumption, all we have in our American schools. That's all being sponsored by a part of our research institute that's called Our Kids Health Foundation. I'm happy to tell you that we've had the fitness gram test, which is the test of aerobic capacity, body weight as percent body fat, or body mass index, upper body strength, lower body strength, and flexibility. To pass this test, being the healthy fitness zone, age and sex adjusted, all you have to be is in the top 80 percentile. But we've found our testing these large numbers of students in Texas, only a third of third graders could pass the test, and less than 10% of the senior high school students could pass the test. It's a national disaster. So our fitness gram is now being accepted around the world, and it's being done to some extent in Canada. I know that a magazine just recently, a Canadian magazine entitled Fitness in Canada, I think that's what it was, featured the work that we're doing here in Texas with the fitness gram testing, getting into schools with nutritional counseling and all of that. We're making some changes in Texas, and the author of the article published in the Canadian magazine was imploring the Canadians, why don't we do the same thing in Canada? Why don't we evaluate our kids and find out how they compare? If what you said is true, if Canadian adults and children are there's less obesity and better activity, they should score much higher. And I challenge the Canadian people to do the testing that we've done here in Texas on children of 3rd to 12th grade. I'd love to see the comparison. And by the way, there's been so much interest in what we're doing in Texas. Other states are already beginning to do that. And this fall, there'll be, there'll be a national organization that's going to be supporting the nationwide testing of children in this country. I'll be going to the UK in September from multiple times I've been there, speaking at a meeting in Birmingham. And that, again, will be promoting what we've done in testing our children in Texas and what we've done to change it. And then I'll have the privilege on the 15th of September to kick off the testing program on the Isle of Jersey in the English Channel. We've got Scotland already involved. We're getting Germany involved. We've got a national, international movement involved. And we think that's the most important things that we can do through our research institute. So those are three major entities of the organization. The third is the Cooper Fitness Center, because I've had to have good scientific data to document the value of exercise, how much is enough is too much. And we had 800 people exercise here on campus yesterday. And that's an average day. And they're up to over 90 years of age. They're still exercising regularly. So we're quantifying what these people are doing daily and correlating it with all risk of mortality and prolonging life. Our data is unbelievable. In fact, of our 100,000-plus patients, we've been trying to follow them to see if they actually increase their longevity and reduce decimal causes, and the data is phenomenal. We're projecting now from 76,000 patients, men and women, who have come to us at least 20 years, come back on a regular basis, that their projected life expectancy for our men is 87.5 years. Our women, 90.5. That's way above the national average. And that alone, we can't prove that yet, because that's still a trend, not an actual measurement. But if that's true, how can you deny the value of preventive medicine the way we practice it here in Dallas?
Oh, that's such fantastic information. I mean, ultimately what you're saying is we've got to use the trump card of the scientific method. We've got to verify whatever it is we say with some science, and you're doing the research and you're proving it out, and you've stood up against criticism and judgment and everything that's coming against exercise, because I'm 100% on the same page. And in fact, we have an education program here, our CSNA, Dr. Cooper, and you can't graduate without having a complete fitness assessment, to submit that, because I believe it's absolutely critical and essential that every patient, every client, every student goes through this process to learn how important it is to measure fitness and its relationship to morbidity and mortality. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. Fitness is not a panacea, but it's the foundation of any good preventive medicine program. In fact, what we teach our patients, our students that come through by the thousands through our Cooper Institute to get certified, that fitness consists of, or wellness rather, consists of these things. Number one is proper weight, proper nutrition, proper supplementation. And we're really emphatic now, we're measuring this on our patients, the importance of vitamin D and omega-3. Those are phenomenal. What we're seeing, the results in the relationship to many diseases, including cancer and heart disease. Number two is elimination of tobacco products in all form. Number three is to control alcohol, elimination of habit-forming drugs. And number four is stress management, control of stress. Number five is the importance of periodic wellness examination. So we do feel that using those that basic concept of wellness, that we can really get tremendous results. And you can't just rely upon weight, percent body fat. Our studies clearly show that you can be overweight and be fit, quote unquote, and you'd be underweight and be unfit, and you're just as bad being underweight and unfit as you are being overweight and fit, which fitness. All it takes is collectively 30 minutes of activities most days per week to get substantial benefits. Our studies indicate that people in that category, compared to people totally sedentary, this is part of our big study we published back in 1989, that if you reach that level, 30 minutes of activity collectively, most days per week, 10 minutes here, 5 minutes here, 15 minutes there, it reduces deaths from all causes, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, and deaths from cancer, by some 58%. And it's also been shown to increase your lifespan by 6 years. If you're in the entire categories of fitness, we call the aerobic category of fitness, that decreases death from all causes by 65% and has potential increase your lifespan by at least 9 years. That's what our studies show. You can only ignore this data for so long before you're ignoring the obvious. And that's why I've been careful to document everything we've done here. We've published over 600 papers now in the last almost 40 years and have safely bridged that gap, as I mentioned earlier, between fatism and scientific legitimacy. But you're exactly right. I'm a man of science. I won't accept anecdotal type things. I want facts. I want double-blind clinical trials. I want observational trials. And that's what we've been doing, and luckily we've been supported very heavily by NIH over the years as far as our research and physical activity.
Now, since your book, Aerobics, was released in 68, and now we've got a lot of people running and jogging, what advice do you have for people that are going into the concept of jogging and running? Is it the same as what you said back then, or have you refined some of the information? Has anything been learned since that time that is really important to know and understand today as a runner, as someone that's into sprinting or interval training or long distance running?
Yes. In 1968, I felt that more was better. Marathons, ultra marathons, more was better. You can't run a good thing in the ground. But by 1982, with the publication of my fifth book, I say if you run more than 15 miles a week, you're running for something other than cardiovascular fitness. Because beyond that point, there's minimal further improvement in aerobic capacity until you exponentially increase the number of miles that you run. But along with that's a marked increase in injuries. And then lately, I've been saying in my books over the last 5 years, or even 10 years, is that you don't have to run. If you just collectively get 30 minutes of activity most days per week, you'll get benefit from a health standpoint. So running is not the answer for older people. I ran for 44 years, and I ran almost 40,000 miles during that time, and I was still running at 74 years of age, but that was December the 29th, 2004, when after 52 years of snow skiing, I fell and fractured my leg, and a tibial plateau fracture. It required two surgeries and necessitated that I stop running. I couldn't run. I have to have a total knee replacement. That's been almost 5 years ago. But the contract transitioned to walking, and I walk fast. And our studies clearly show if you could walk a mile in 12 minutes, that's very fast. That's equivalent of running a mile in 9 minutes. If you walk a mile in 13 minutes, that's equivalent of a 10-minute mile. Even 14 minutes is about 11 or 12-minute mile. So if you break the 15-minute mile barrier, 4 miles per hour, you can get some aerobic benefit. They don't have to walk that fast. We show clearly that you could walk, you could run 2 miles in less than 20 minutes four times a week and get aerobic benefit, but you could walk 3 miles in 45 minutes 5 days a week at the same benefit. Or if you just don't even have to even do that much, if you just walk 2 miles in 30 minutes and do that three times a week, or 2 miles in 35 minutes four times a week, or 2 miles in 40 minutes 5 days a week, you get benefit. So if you've got a desire, we've got the way for you to do it. But the most important thing I tell my people to do is listen to your body. If you start breaking down, if you start having chest pain, unusual shortness of breath, don't ignore that. Follow through. Then we can make exercise very safe. It was said at one time that you can expect one death every 10,000 miles of running and one heart attack every 1,000 miles of running. That's what I fought back in 1960 to 1970. So we'll be careful to document how risky is running, jogging. So we've been doing that since 1970. The last count, we had had over 15 million miles had been run on the tracks at the aerobic center. Our people keep records, as you know, you've been here, keep records on a daily basis. We've had at least 5 million miles have been swum. We have at least 10 million miles of cycling and about 5,000 hours at least of aerobic dance classes. Average age is 48 years. We've had only one major cardiac event in all those years. Why? Luck? No. I think it's because we demand that people over 40 years of age have a maximum performance treadmill stress test before they start into a program. Women over 50 years of age. And that needs to be repeated every 3 years because you can't store fitness. Majority of people follow that guideline. As a result, we pick up early heart disease all the time and correct it so it can be done safely. To give you an example of that, a good friend of mine, a patient by the name of Orville Rogers. I first saw him 35 years ago. At the present time, just within the last 2 years, he set two world records in Boston. This is in 2008, during the spring of 2008, when he ran his mile in 9 minutes and 58 seconds and broke the record by a minute and a half. His half mile in 4 minutes and 18 seconds broke the record by 30 seconds for men over 90 years of age. Two world records in a weekend. Just a few weeks ago, he won 5 gold medals in senior athletic events here in Dallas. But the point is, in 1993, because he was coming through the clinic on a regular basis without any chest pain, he had severe coronary disease. He had a 6-vessel bypass procedure done 16 years ago. My point is, he listened to his body. He followed our recommendation, and we picked up disease which would have killed him years ago. So it's a combination of proper exercise, but proper evaluation, regular evaluations, listening to your body, and that's the way you can make exercise safe and effective as we do here in Dallas.
We know that motivation, human motivation, is a function of necessity and desire, and you said the word desire. Now, you know what needs to be done. We can tell people the science is there, it's irrefutable. Why do we have such a strong problem with non-compliance, with people that start the programs and then they struggle? They struggle with food, they struggle with diet, they struggle with training, they struggle with doing the work that needs to be done. Can you explain that?
You know, people ask me over the years, I'm now 78 years of age, work out regularly, working 60 hours a week. Is there any word that would explain your success, physically, professionally, whatever it may be? I thought about that for a long time. Now, I finally came up with the word discipline, highly disciplined. Ask my staff. First one here in the morning, last one to leave, very faithful exercise program. My weight's the same as it was when I was in high school. And I don't smoke, I don't drink, I'm highly disciplined. Very strong in my beliefs, I study my Bible daily. And I was pleased to see that paraphrase in Proverbs 13:18 was a statement, shame and poverty come to those who are not disciplined. I think that's what we lack in America, in Canada, is a sense of discipline. We go the easy way. We go the way that's not difficult, non-sweating. I think that's the major reason why that we have obesity problems, we have drug problems, we have gang problems, is the lack of discipline. The other thing, too, and we found this with testing these children, as well as testing all the adults that come to this clinic, it's a four-step approach that we use. to try to get them involved and keep them involved, not a one-time affair. The first step is to have a very thorough evaluation. Find out what your percent body fat is. How does it compare with people in your age group? Find out what your cholesterol, your blood pressure, your time on the treadmill, aerobic fitness. How does it compare? People are usually shocked about how they compare with other people, their age, their sex. That's a great motivator. Number two, it must be an educational motivational experience. And that's why our physicians see only three patients a day. Spend an hour and a half with each patient so we can educate them, can motivate them. Number three, we give them recommendations on how to change their lifestyle. They're safe, effective, and realistic. Don't overwhelm the patient when he comes in who's overweight, smoking, drinking too much, totally inactive. You tell these people you got to stop smoking, stop drinking, lose weight, start exercising. You overwhelm them. They won't come back. You got many problems. Let's take them one at a time. That's number three. And then number four is get them back. Follow up. That's the best way to ensure progress, to keep them motivated, is have discipline, number one, and have a discipline program they have to follow, number two. Get them back. Monitor progress, and that's the reason we've had such great success.
Now, you and I both know there are millions of good athletes that eat terribly. They eat French fries, hamburgers, they have milkshakes, they drink pop as a staple. A lot of these are kids growing up in the public school system. Now, how important is nutrition not only to athletic performance, but to our well-being in life?
Well, there's just no question about that. If you look at American Heart Association standards, recommendations are 50-55% complex carbohydrate, 15% protein, and less than 25-30% fat, of which 7% is a saturated fat, by the way, but emphasize the monos and the polys, and then consume less than 300 milligrams of cholesterol per day. That's a basic recommendation, which I encourage my people to follow. And we found following that recommendation, many times we can lower cholesterol, lower triglycerides, blood sugar, without any medications at all. Another simple thing that I tell my patients as a model that we use is 5 is fine, 9 is divine. The number of servings of fruits and vegetables you should be consuming daily. The average American adult, 3.1. Average American teenager, 1.6. I would dare say that it's better in Canada as far as nutrition than what we have in the United States, which may be a factor in your better health and your obesity. So those are fairly simple rules. And so I try to get at least 6 or 7 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. I think that's one reason why I'm enjoying good health. So nutrition is extremely important. But again, a lot of people don't realize just what they're consuming when they misread the labels, and some of the labels aren't correct as far as how many calories that they have in them. We've made some major changes. I've worked with PepsiCo and Frito-Lay for the last 5.5 years. I did for 5.5 years. And we had a major impact on the snack foods with Frito-Lay by taking all the trans fats out. That removes about 50 million pounds of trans fat in the American diet every year. And then now we've removed 60 million pounds of saturated fats from their products every year. And we have now changed the oil. It's a new Sun type oil that is 81% mono and polyunsaturated fats. And the FDA allows us to put on these packages now. This has been shown to be heart healthy. That's what I'm talking about. I've said for years, you're not going to control the obesity problem in children by taking the vending machines out to schools. What you've got to do is put better products in the vending machines, educate and motivate the kids to eat these products, and then bring PE back into schools. That's the way we'll resolve the obesity problem in children. So those are things I've tried to do personally to make better products because and try to be realistic with my approach. And that's one reason we had such great success here in Texas.
Outstanding information and advice. In the antioxidant revolution, you stressed the importance of antioxidants to protect us from oxidation. Are you still driving that message home?
Yes, as you know, though, there's been a lot of criticism of the beta carotene, the vitamin C, vitamin E, things of that type. But again, most of the studies, like they're making a mistake. They're going to be starting this big study, as I mentioned, 20,000 people they're going to be following. Looking at the benefits, just starting it now, of omega-3 and vitamin D, reducing deaths from heart attacks and cancer. So there's great interest in omega-3 and vitamin D, but they make a mistake. And starting the study with people 60 years of age, I wouldn't expect much of a change. The problem with the studies that are so critical of beta-carotene and vitamin C and vitamin E, the basic antioxidants, are short-term being 5 to 10 years. It takes 15 to 20 years or longer to to show the benefits. They tend to ignore, and they talk about the Finney study of 28,000 men followed for some 4.6 years, and they show those men who were consuming high levels of beta-carotene actually had an increase in lung cancer. And beta-carotene is supposed to protect you from lung cancer. But these men were all heavy smokers. They'd been smoking a pack and a half a day for 36 years or longer. And so it takes up to 15 years for a lung cancer to develop. And very likely, a lot of those men who already had lung cancer just hadn't been diagnosed when they started on the beta-carotene. But the point is, that was done 20 years ago or longer. They went back and analyzed the data some 20 years later and found there was protective effect of the beta-carotene on lung cancer. It just took a whole lot longer than they anticipated. So the basic studies that are critiquing, double-blind clinical trials, that are critiquing the value of antioxidants, particularly C and beta-carotene, I challenge most of those because they're too short. They work with patients who already have disease, and I've never said that antioxidants go into treat disease unless you have beriberi or pellagra or something like that or scurvy, but I'm saying that it can be very beneficial in preventing disease if you start early enough, particularly the micro diseases, not the macro diseases. So, yes, I still put all my patients on antioxidants, but I'm very, very emphatic now, and we're doing the studies on this, as I mentioned, of the importance of vitamin D and omega-3, and that's going to be a breakthrough. Something as simple as vitamin D and cancer. From the studies we read, vitamin D deficiencies are related to cancer of the prostate, cancer of the breast, cancer of the ovary, cancer of the kidneys. There's at least 17. But the big ones we're interested in are prostate and breast because we know that the Afro-American has a much higher incidence of cancer of the breast and cancer of the prostate. And invariably, among my Afro-American patients come through the clinic, their vitamin D levels are just almost non-existent. And been able to get those up fairly rapidly by putting them on high doses of vitamin D. And it wouldn't be remarkable if the reason that the Afro-American has a higher incidence of breast cancer, prostate cancer, is because they can't manufacture vitamin D with their skin, that we could supplement vitamin D and have a major turnaround in the incidence of prostate and breast cancer in Afro-Americans. So that's one of the exciting things we're doing right now. And obviously, I said the U.S. government, NIH and all, are equally exciting. But no, getting back to the basic antioxidants, yes, and then your questions, I know you ask about free radical damage that can occur with exercise. At high levels, it does. In fact, there is some concern about if you exercise too much beyond the point of exhaustion and fatigue, world-class training, you might say, is that you may be increasing the risk of cancer, called that the Lance Armstrong syndrome. And there's too many world-class athletes who've come down with cancer that they should have been protected from. Some studies were done in Ulm, Germany a few years ago, and they took world-class athletes and they test them to exhaustion with a treadmill, and they measure the DNA damage that occurred after the exercise. And they measured it immediately after 6, 12, 24, and 36 hours, and found that the major DNA damage occurred 24 hours after the exercise. If you're a marathoner, you know what I'm talking about, because the muscle pain isn't that bad the first few hours after the marathon, but the next day you can't walk downstairs if you walk down backwards because it's so sore. That correlates with the DNA damage in the muscles. But what they showed in Germany, if you put these men 1,200 units of vitamin E per day for 2 weeks prior to the run, it almost totally suppressed the DNA damage in these athletes. So that may be, I have an all recommendation from all of my lead athletes, you've got to take high doses of the antioxidants. So no, I've not changed my mind at all. I think that so much literature is just invalid because it hasn't been long enough to document the true value, complete value of antioxidants.
Time for one more question or statement. What is the most important point that you can make in your latest book, Start Strong, Finish Strong?
My goal is to help you live a long, healthy life to the fullest and then die suddenly. If we could do that, the quality of our life would be phenomenal. The cost of health care would go through the floor if we could do that. I'm convinced that is possible if you follow the guidelines that we give you and Start Strong, Finish Strong, quoted by my son and myself, which are based on the ones I've already given you for wellness. Do that. Don't ignore the importance of periodic wellness examination, stress tests, things of that type, blood lipid analysis. Exercise regularly. It's not what you did 6 months ago. It's what you did yesterday. It counts. You can't use tobacco in any form. And very, very important, Avoid side stream smoke. Limit your alcohol to no more than a drink a day. Studies indicate that may have some beneficial effects as far as longevity. But the most important thing is realize, the philosopher Peggy once said, when a man dies, he dies not so much the disease he has, he dies of his entire life. It is your responsibility. If you don't take care of yourself, no one else is going to do it.
Fantastic. And your website, please, Dr. Cooper.
CooperAerobics.com.
So all of our students, all the members out there, get to this website. Learn about the personal training certification, the education programs, and everything that the Cooper Institute has to offer. Dr. Cooper, our time is gone. Thank you so much for a great interview, for your marvelous insight, your vast experience, a lifetime that you've pulled from reality, you've tested, you've done the work, you talked about discipline, desire, you hit the nail right on the head. It's just a privilege to have you as our special guest on this edition of SNU.
Thank you, Corey. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Represent your lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight, Malik, with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life, live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.